I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about something that can affect not just your health and safety, but that of the ones you love most. We're going to talk about how we can prevent home fires and how we should deal with them when they do occur. My guests are Chad Priest, Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross, Indiana, and Charles Miramonte, Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about home fires, about how they occur and what we can do to prevent them, also what we can do when they do occur. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chad Priest. He is Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross, Indiana. Dr. Charles Miramonte. He is Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. He's also Chief Medical Officer for the Mesh Coalition, and I should say they're both on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Absolutely. So pleasure to be here.
Certainly. So we should talk first, probably set the give some people some idea of how large a problem this is. How many home fires do we have? We can go within either Indianapolis or Indiana. What is the rate of incidence?
I think for perspective, the American Red Cross is known for our disaster response. Most of those disasters around the United States are related to home fires. So every day in Indiana, we're responding to about 6 home fires. That puts us at the bottom of the country, which is, in terms of the frequency and rate of these events. And they're extraordinarily disruptive. I mean, these are life-altering, life-changing events. And home fires are like many other disasters. And as we talk today, we may expand that for the other discussion. But it's a serious problem in Indiana. And for perspective, just in December, the month of December, we responded to 133 fires. That was December of 16. We had 10 fatalities just in the month of December. Last year, 61 fatalities in the state. So it's a significant issue.
Is it, when you say the 130, is that for Indiana as a whole or is it for Indianapolis?
No, that's for Indiana as a whole. And those are just the ones we responded to. We would love to be able to say we respond to every single event. But the truth is sometimes victims don't contact us or clients don't contact us. It's an extraordinary number.
So by my math, if we're talking about 6 a day, that puts us somewhere in the range of 2,000 of these every year. And those are the ones that are just reported.
Yeah, I think it's higher than that.
Much higher than that. What's the human toll, Charlie?
The human toll, it's hard to say what the human toll really is. And if we want to just say lives lost, obviously we look at across the country, thousands of lives lost every year. But more, maybe even more impactful is our livelihoods that are lost. The homes that we have built are lost, healthcare costs, the insurance cost, the cost of the community, the cost of opportunities lost, potential lost. That stuff becomes immeasurable, which is why so much of the infrastructure work that the Red Cross has done and that we do on a municipal level here at the city becomes more and more important, not just for home fires and whatnot, but for a variety of disasters that plague our communities. Just off the top of my head, the heroin epidemic for another perfect example of how infrastructure plays a major role in how we respond to these things.
So sticking with the home fires, although my guess is when we're talking about opioids and other problems, fire plays some role in a lot of that too. What are the primary causes of these fires? Which are the ones? Well, we'll start with that. What are the primary causes, Chad?
Yeah, I think there's a really important overarching social point which should be made, which is that fires are not equal opportunity disasters. Certainly anyone can have a fire, but these are disasters that are closely tied to socioeconomic status. And that's a problem. It's a problem for all of us. And so your point about the opioid epidemic, it relates to vacant and abandoned housing. It relates to the homeless members of our community who squat or live in abandoned places. In the wintertime, the risks are obvious. Space heaters, oftentimes, again, tied to socioeconomic status. People using inappropriate methods to heat their home, whether that's using stoves, using dangerous space heaters, or in some cases, actually using flames. Those are all risks for home fires. And, of course, the biggest predictor of your ability to be safe in a fire is a working smoke alarm, which is not going to prevent the fire from occurring, but certainly will help save lives in the event it does.
How many homes in Indiana, do we have any numbers, do not have smoke alarms at this point?
I don't know the answer to that, but I will say that one of our largest programs is the Home Fire Campaign in the state. We are committed to ensuring that we reduce the number of lives lost. And so to that end, last year we installed 15,000 smoke alarms. This year we'll install 20,000 smoke alarms in the state. And we have a few communities in which we're going to reach 100% saturation. Brazil, Indiana comes to mind. They had a tragic December with six or seven fatalities in the course of 3 or 4 days. Working with the mayor, on the phone with the mayor the day of the a particularly tragic fire, we committed to install a smoke alarm in every home in Brazil. And that's something that we hope to have accomplished by May. And we've largely accomplished that in Huntington, Indiana. I can't tell you the numbers, but what I can tell you is that there is a huge need for working smoke alarms in homes.
We are talking about home fires here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Kevin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
We had a house fire a couple of years ago, and one thing that I had noticed was that there were some firefighters whose it seemed like their sole purpose was to go into the house and, you know, find memorabilia, pictures, school photos, that kind of stuff, you know, and take them out of the house to save them from the fire. So my question is just how prevalent, you know, those types of firefighters are on various forces. Is that something that's unique to Indianapolis, and is that really their purpose to do that?
Kevin, before I pass that on to Charlie, I'm going to ask, presumably they were preserving the memorabilia for you, right? Not taking it for themselves, right?
No, yes, exactly.
Okay, I wanted to clarify that and make sure we understood it. All right, thanks very much for the call and the question, Kevin.
Thanks.
Sure thing. Charlie.
To speak hopefully well enough on behalf of our brothers and sisters on the fire department here, I'm not aware of any special units that are trained and implemented to go do that specific kind of work. I will say the folks that we have the true honor and pleasure of working with on an everyday basis are unbelievably committed to the community, to the families, to their profession in such a way that stories like that are not uncommon. Folks who will go back in and try to get the things, as we had talked about earlier, put your lives back together that matter in terms of a fire, let alone once, you know, they've done everything they can to save life and property and whatnot.
What are the things, I'm calling this up from some personal memory. My mother's house had a fire when I was a teenager many, many years ago, right around the time fire was discovered. And I remember at that time, we didn't worry about possessions so much as it was, okay, everybody's got to get out of the house. And then it occurred to us, okay, we had some pets, and we were running back into the house to get the pets. What are the things that preoccupy people the most when this happens to them? I'm going to give each of you a crack at it. Chad can go first because he's leaning in.
Well, okay. I did that because I had the occasion to teach a group of second graders at CFI 84 and IPS school here in town on this very topic, and so it's top of mind, which is, you know, look, you've got about 2 minutes to get out of your house in a fire. And we say it over and over, but the importance is to get out, stay out, call 911. And, you know, it's funny when you talk to children, they get this instinctively. It's their parents who need the coaching. So a lot of times we ask the kids to go reinforce with their parents that, no, it's not important to get your framed certificate of whatever, that those things can be replaced, but ultimately your lives cannot.
Charlie.
I just echo what Chad had to say. It's all relatively replaceable. At the end of the day, the lives are not. Get out, stay out, that's it.
So we've got this problem, and have the numbers steadily increased or decreased over time? We're looking at about 2,000 in the state of Indiana annually, and, you know, 61 people died last year, 10 of them in December. Are there more times of the year that fires are more prevalent, Chad?
Yeah, definitely. We definitely see in the winter months there's an uptick in fires. I don't know about raw numbers. Again, I think the 2,000 number is probably even lower than the actual incidents. That's just what we've responded to. I will say that that we are seeing in densely populated urban areas where there are abandoned buildings that are being used, that there are significant fatalities. And I know that what makes those particularly challenging, and again, I defer to the chief here and don't want to speak for Chief Malone, and IFD is an extraordinary partner of ours, but it's very dangerous for the firefighters in those situations as well. They're going into areas where they don't know if there are people. Mm-hmm. And as these abandoned buildings light up, there are often people, and that becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I would say nationally trends have gone down in terms of a gross number of home fires across the country. The fire departments, IFF, and other initiatives across our country have just done.
What is IFF?
Sorry. It's the International Association of Firefighters, okay. A huge advocacy group for firefighters and for home fire prevention. Have just done an amazing job on the educational front on so many different initiatives, even starting in at the school level with kids today. Many field trips run through our Survive Alive house here in Indianapolis, where they learn all the tips and tricks of home fire safety.
What accounts for, you say the numbers have dropped in recent years nationally. What specific things are people doing to reduce the incidence?
It's really been education. I would, again, I'm speaking on behalf of our partners at the fire department and whatnot. But it's really been their incredible educational initiatives, fire inspections, smoke detectors, the campaigns around fire extinguishers in the home and cooking areas and things like that. All those initiatives take a chunk out of the total number, and they have just done an amazing job at injury prevention in this space.
We've gotten a comment from a listener named Greg via Facebook, and if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Greg writes, please stop distributing the smoke detectors that only have the ion method. Instead, please distribute the models that use the photo and ion methods to help assure that the detectors function when needed. Also, remind your audience to check their alarms and batteries. Okay, we need to break down what the ion method is and what the photo and ion method and why this matters.
Well, first, I want to thank the contributor. He's absolutely right with respect to batteries in general. We often find when we're in homes installing alarms that we'll get to homes that do not have batteries. So they believe they have a working alarm. They've either removed the battery because maybe it's gone off from cooking flames or something like that, or from smoke, and not put it in, or it's simply gone dead. We've all experienced running around looking for the chirp, and that's a real issue, mm-hmm. and it's a real safety issue. There are several different kinds of smoke alarms. I am not an engineer. I did sleep at a Holiday Inn Express once, but I am not qualified. We're very confident. Our smoke alarm program does provide a 10-year lithium-ion battery in part, so that you do not have to change the batteries. We've determined in partnership with the NFPA and our partners at fire departments that that's the most effective alarm to use, but it's not the only kind. We also offer alarms for folks with sensory deprivation, either those who are blind, disabled, or hard of hearing, who obviously require different sort of alarms to be effective.
What is the distinction, though? I want to get it. What's the difference between just an ion battery and a photo and ion battery? Charlie, can you answer that?
I am not smart enough to know anything about that. I barely got through engineering and just have enough to remember medicine.
Well, maybe, Greg, if you could follow up on with a Facebook message and explain to us what the differences are so that we could inform the audience. That's one of the great things about this program is we have a smart audience that can provide information
Absolutely.
Like that. We are talking about how home fires, how often they occur, how we can prevent them, and we will be talking about what we can do when they do occur. My guests are Chad Priest. He's Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross Indiana, and Dr. Charles Miramonte. He is Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. He's also Chief Medical Officer for Mesh Coalition. They're both on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about home fires and other disasters here on No Limits. My guests are Chad Priest, who is Chief Executive Officer, the American Red Cross, Indiana, and Dr. Charles Miramonte, who is Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. He's also Chief Medical Officer for Mesh Coalition, and they're both on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. Got an email from a listener named Chelsea, who asks a pretty simple question. What can we do to help locally for the Red Cross or EMS? Each of you gets a crack at that. I'll let Charlie go first on that one.
Chelsea, thank you for actually a very insightful question. There's actually quite a bit on both the Red Cross front as well as on the emergency medical services side. We were just talking a second during the break about resiliency and what makes communities more resilient to crises like these, any sort of epidemics or the disasters that pop up throughout our country and throughout our cities. And there are really a variety of factors, and most of those come down to nothing more than simple relationships and relationship building. It's anything that builds neighborhoods. It's anything that builds communities. Knowing your neighbors around you, being a safe space for your neighbors around you, having hubs to the community like churches and community centers and things like that. Those are, as we've seen in the research, as we've seen in the literature that's played out over the last half dozen years or so, those are some of the major factors that really, really make a difference for communities to survive.
Charlie's absolutely right. I think specifically with respect to home fires, we need help. For us to reach the target number of homes we want to make safer this year, we need volunteers, and listeners can call the Red Cross anywhere in the state and come and volunteer to go install. You know, 97% of the Red Cross workforce is volunteers. And while the smoke alarms are really important, we've saved a number of lives this year alone. They also give us a chance for neighbors to walk into neighbors' homes, and let us not underestimate the power of that. And that is what Charlie's talking about getting to know your neighbors. And so Chelsea and anyone listening can come and install smoke alarms. It's actually an amazing volunteer experience. Requires about 30 minutes of just-in-time training we give you before you set out. Teams of three go into homes. We drill them to the walls. We don't pass out smoke alarms. Too often firefighters find smoke alarms on kitchen counters without batteries melted from fires. We put them right on the wall, and it's an amazing opportunity to be in communion, if you will, with your neighbors.
Is that sense of resilience and, you know, this community awareness, do you have numbers that show the effectiveness, or is that one of those things that's what the lawyers like to say, you have to prove a negative there?
That's a great question.
We've got great research on this. We know Rand did a huge meta study, and there have been other research that demonstrate very positively the social determinants of resilience, which right among them is social cohesion. Do you know your neighbors? And interestingly, the factors in our community over many years that have changed, decreased participation in communal sporting events, attached garages with automatic door openers, have all, in very small ways, chipped away at this relationship we have with the people who live next to us. And
the whole bowling alone
is very much the Robert Putnam got this started with his book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, the programs that are out there, CPR, Marion County Health Department, alongside IEMS, just started a really innovative program to do Narcan administration education for families and whatnot and for community settings. There's just it's just showing up. It's just like the rest of life. It's really just about showing up and participating at that level. And even if it's just door to door, the guys on the left and to the right of you, or even at more of a communal level or at a municipal level, which we want to participate. But those are the things that matter.
We've gotten a request from a listener named Michael via Twitter. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Michael writes, please speak about the psychological footprint of fires and role of psychological first aid. Charlie, I'll throw that one to you first.
Sure. Psychological first aid is a phenomenal program or tool set, really. It plays at a variety of spaces, not just for the victims of any particular event, but also for the providers, also for the volunteers who participate. And psychological first aid is so incredibly important. It really flagging and addressing the mental-emotional symptoms, if you will, of any of those participants in a disaster up front so that they can be mitigated and addressed. And psych first aid has really done probably more than anything on the medical side to really drill home resiliency on the scene. It keeps providers in the mix longer. It keeps the scene safer. You take care of your people up front. And it's also a toolbox of very successful strategies to manage your volunteers and to manage your participants up front. And so we've used psych first aid in a variety of ways over the years, both for the victims of any particular event as well as for our providers at a critical stress debriefing way.
When we talk about resilience and community, the role of community in dealing with this, I'm hearing echoes of, you know, before he left, we'd had Indianapolis Police Chief Troy Riggs here talking about combating crime. Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogg said same thing, and they were talking about a holistic approach to reducing crime and involving, you know, the whole community in attempting to deal with this. Is this a variation of the same theme? Are we talking about the same sorts of things? I want to hear both of your thoughts on this. We'll start with Chad, but then I'll go to Charlie.
No, they are. We've been very fortunate in Indianapolis with leadership, both Chief Riggs, Mayor Hogsett, and his predecessor, Mayor Ballard. It's absolutely right. In the emergency management space, we talk about a whole-of-community approach, which is we're a response-oriented culture in America. I mean, we're really good at responding stuff. And obviously, the chief sees that every day in the emergency department. That isn't the most efficient and effective way to respond to crises. And so it's going to be incumbent upon us to be much more aggressive on these social determinants of resilience. They are the things that will keep our community safe. And where we've targeted zip codes in this city very effectively for needs, one thing that can't be forgotten is that we're not talking about delivering services to people. We're talking about people in communities delivering services to themselves. And that is the key and something I think we've been very successful with here in Indianapolis.
Charlie. Yeah,
absolutely. Where to begin? In terms of the infrastructure development, the holistic approach is absolutely probably the most important and probably in terms of disaster management over the last 15, 20 years has been the last approach that we've really taken. We really have, especially in the healthcare environment, just gone after this. We'll put lots of stuff on shelves. We'll have lots of tracking software and things that we'll actually never use on the day-to-day and call that prepared. We'll have boxes of gloves and medicines and we'll say we're prepared, but that's really not what prepares healthcare entities. It's not what prepares cities and communities, if you will. It is infrastructure. It is the day-to-day that prepares a community. And so I was so privileged to work under Chief Riggs when he was Director of Public Safety, and alongside him as a police chief. Much of our approaches to public safety have the same philosophy in that holistic manner. And what I think Chad and I have done through a variety of agencies, and really within our mentality and our philosophy, has to go out and build that infrastructure, as the relationships between EMS and fire and police and how they relate back into healthcare, being able to manage multi-billion dollar healthcare entities as a collective to get them to participate and work together through crises that we do with MESH, be able to tie all that back into public safety and public safety response at the Emergency Operations Center level, at the police and fire level, to give them the tools that they need to do that work. That's really where the rubber meets the road. It is not in the response. True disaster work happens on building an infrastructure that serves you on a very day-to-day basis efficiently, intelligently, holistically.
Is some of the focus, though, on the other approach that you were talking about?
Absolutely.
Is the fact that it is easier to quantify and to demonstrate, oh, yes, we're ready. We have, 200,000 sets of gloves, and, no matter what happens, people are going to go out there without bare hands, and we're fine. Saying we have a community instead that, A, it's much harder to demonstrate. The numbers are harder, and the data becomes much harder to collect. Chad, you're leaning in, so I'm going to stop talking and let you start.
I think it's a good point, and I think it's a bit of a trap, which is, I think, and I feel for government agencies in particular, because often they're administering large programs that focus on things like how many gloves can we get, or how many antibiotics can we push off the back of a truck in the case of a biological attack. Yeah. Well, the truth is there'll never be enough antibiotics to push. Does that mean we shouldn't stockpile? No, that's not what we're saying at all. I think what we're seeing and we're seeing play out in real time is that it's not soft to say that knowing your neighbors makes you safer. In many ways, it's a return to first principles. It's a return to the root of early emergency management. It isn't the soft side to say when corporations and NGOs partner with government agencies that have built stronger communities, that we've got an entire history in America where that's worked. I think what's deceptive is a feeling of comfort that emerges from saying, "Hey, like you said, we've got plenty of gloves." Well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather my neighborhood not exist in a floodplain. Mm-hmm. I'd rather us mitigate the flood. And I'm not criticizing anyone. In fact, everyone agrees on this. Our emergency management partners, the chief, the police, everybody. We have got to look beyond response. That doesn't mean response doesn't have a role. It does. It's essential. But frankly, that is a short-sighted way to think about building safer communities. The truth is, if you know your neighbors, you're in communion with them, you're more likely to help them yourself. And that's a big deal.
And that exists for corporations and companies, organizations Absolutely. As well, that same Absolutely. Principle. And we've proven that on the MESH side over and over again. If I could
Sure.
quickly, two examples come to mind to your question. First would be the Richmond Hill, very focused, awful event, mm-hmm. Expanded over minutes to hours, and then we were in recovery and whatnot. And in that particular situation, having that sort of stuff mattered. State fair, stage collapse, having all that stuff mattered. Being able to implement it, deploy it, use it in a very smart fashion mattered. Fast forward now to today, and again, I bring this up, the heroin epidemic. All the stuff in the world, all the stuff on shelves, all the software you can find online is not the answer. It has been the relationships and being able to put smart people from all these different disciplines and spaces around the same table and then come at a solution together. So, for example, here in Indianapolis, we are partnering with this city, with police, with Midtown Mental Health, with all of the mental health entities around Central Indiana. We're using software being developed specifically for MESH to be used in that space to do bed tracking and to do resource utilization for those folks. But being able to come at something from multiple different attacks, if you will, only because you've got the relationships in place to make it happen.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Jeff. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jeff asks, why are smoke detectors not hardwired to electrical systems in every home? Chad.
We have to be very careful about waging in, as you know, to political issues. We don't get involved and don't take opinions. But it's a great question. And in some cases, for new code and new construction, those requirements do exist. The issue is for residential homes that are older, where construction codes or requirements wouldn't have existed, is going in and fixing them. But that's an issue that I know is discussed frequently. In fact, I think there's legislation this year that's been introduced. We're getting carbon monoxide detectors, a very, you know, obviously different. But that's a great question, and one we don't get into, other than to say that in most instances, the homes or facilities are too old for codes to keep current.
Got another email question from a listener who says, our family lost several family members to carbon monoxide poisoning several years ago. What's the most important message you can convey about carbon monoxide poisoning at this time of year? Charlie.
There's a couple. We see these tragedies every year this time of year, I should say, in the emergency department on the EMS side. A few things that I would stress to folks is regular checks on your heaters, furnaces. That is incredibly important. And then not really – I know this is hard for lots of families in the listening area, but not using some of the methods that Chad had pointed out earlier, ovens, open flame in contained areas, several kinds of space heaters that the same in contained areas. Ventilation is critical. But I can't stress enough having a carbon monoxide detector on every single floor and having those heaters and furnaces checked every year.
So, would the carbon monoxide, I'm going to ask the obvious question, carbon monoxide detector, is that different from the smoke detector?
It is absolutely different
than
a smoke
detector.
It has to be bought separately from a smoke detector in most instances. And generally, you want those to be on the floor or on the lower levels of the wall, if you will, on every floor. That's where they're best.
And, you know, when we talk about the 61 people who died in Indiana last year because of fires, does that include the folks who we lose because of carbon monoxide poisoning, or is that a separate category?
I think it's separate.
Separate category, so there could be even more people that we're talking about who you know succumb to this problem. We've talked about the fact that we target this crime and some of these other issues by zip code, that there are certain areas, and I think it was Chad who alluded to the fact that there are socioeconomic components to this. Who are the folks who are most likely to have their lives ended or damaged by house fires, and what can we do about it?
I think clearly poor communities are at higher risk. We've seen that time and time again. I think where infrastructure is weak, there's an increased risk, and sometimes infrastructure is a function of, we talked about older housing units, et cetera. I wanted to mention that does not mean that in low resource communities that this is inevitable. We just left a wonderful meeting with leaders, community leaders, and political leaders from Mars Hill, an area of our city that has low resource but is banding together to work on smoke alarm programs.
Are those folks, and what sort of interventions, you know, I know with the crime thing, there were specific interventions that we were trying to do in those communities. What are the kind of interventions we can do to prevent the kind of home or other fires or other disasters? Either one of you, you're both looking at each other. One of you's got to
Well,
tell you.
we're interchangeable on a few questions.
Okay.
At the end of the day, a neighbor knocking on a neighbor's door with a smoke alarm is the most powerful intervention, and teaching children to get out of the house, things that volunteers can do with the Red Cross by simply calling our office at 317-684-1441.
Go ahead and give them that number again.
That's 317-684-1441, and you can call that number to volunteer to install smoke alarms. But more importantly, you can call that number and we will come to your home and install a smoke alarm for you at no cost.
And do you have a URL that they can use too?
They can go to redcross.org and they can find Indiana right there.
We are talking about home fires and other disasters here on No Limits and how you can prevent them. My guests are Chad Priest, who is Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross Indiana, and Dr. Charles Miramonte. He is Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services and Chief Medical Officer of the Mesh Coalition. Both are on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about home fires and other disasters here on No Limits. My guests are Chad Priest, who is the chief executive officer of the American Red Cross, Indiana, and Dr. Charles Miramonte, who is chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. He's also chief medical officer for Mesh Coalition, and they're both on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. We've gotten, in the first segment, we had a question about the difference between ion and photo smoke detectors. And I asked the listener who posed the question, Greg, if he had information to follow up, which he's done, on our Facebook page. So I would direct our listeners there. Greg says, you are welcome. A local TV broadcast covered the matter years ago. Ionization method detects smoke from flaming fire. Photoelectric method detects smoke from smoldering fire. The TV news report noted an alarm that did not sound beacon the fire was not because the fire was not compatible to the alarm. The last I checked, the IFD and Red Cross only distribute models with the ionization method. And Greg says he's going to post a link, offers to post a link to explain the difference. Greg, please do. And listeners, please go to our Facebook page at any time, obviously, to get more information because the discussion doesn't stop just because the hour ends. Yes, Chad.
Well, again, we appreciate that comment. The Red Cross and our partners, both at IFD and at fire departments around the country, will only install alarms that meet UL217 testing criteria, including both ionization or photoelectric alarms. And so the Consumer Product Safety Commission has acknowledged that both are okay. Both types of alarms meet the requirements. But it's an important discussion to have. It's one we welcome. We choose to use ionization alarms. That's what our partners at the fire department, and we've worked closely with the state fire marshal and others to have this discussion. We're comfortable with what we're doing, but I appreciate Greg's interest. And the more we're talking about smoke alarms, the more we're talking about this discussion. That's a good thing, and we welcome it.
Yeah, I want to echo my thanks to Greg because one of the best things about this show is I get to talk to so many smart people. Thanks very much for following up, Greg. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Susan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Susan, welcome to the program.
My question has to do with carbon monoxide and heaters, stoves, et cetera. There's never any distinction between electric and gas. And I thought that it takes a gas appliance to actually cause a carbon monoxide buildup rather than, say, an electric heater. I was just curious, is that right or not?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, and I hope you enjoy your workout. Thanks.
Thank
much.
You.
All right, Charlie.
First of all, easy on the workout. Take your time.
Okay.
Carbon monoxide is actually a byproduct of any burn, so any open flame, if you will. So the electric devices, while they are let me be clear on this, they are still a strong fire risk. They are not a carbon monoxide risk per se.
Anything that generates significant amounts of heat, right, is a risk for for a home fire.
Yes.
So actually, we've alluded to the fact that one of the things that symbols of resilience is also preparing people to deal with fire. We haven't specifically talked about what they should do when one occurs. This might be the right moment to do that. Chad, I'll go with you first, then Charlie.
This is a great time for me to tell the folks listening what we tell the second, third, and fourth graders around Indiana, which is when you hear your smoke alarm, we want you to get out of the house, stay out of the house, and call 911. That's easier said than done if you are going around looking for pets or items. But the truth is, having a meeting spot, practicing that meeting spot, and getting out of the house is critically important. We teach children to feel a door before they exit, and if the door feels warm, go through a series of questions about what's the safest exit route. Is there another door out of the room? If there is clearly smoke coming in, we don't want people opening that door, going out in smoke. We teach children to open the window and not jump. I've had some elementary school students say, awesome, we just jump out the window. That's not the right answer. But opening the window, hailing for firefighters is the key. And, of course, the condition precedent to all of this is to have a working smoke alarm with a battery that you have tested, preferably monthly, and to have a rendezvous point outside for you and your family.
Now, I remember from years ago, again, back when fire was first discovered, and I was learning those drills, they always taught you, if there's smoke, to stay low to the ground.
Get
Is
low,
that still
stay
the
low.
Case? Yeah. Charlie?
Absolutely, stay low. And just to emphasize what Chad had to say, having a plan that is practice is critical. I have 5 kids. I have an 8 and a 6-year-old that defy logic on a day to day basis. So making sure that
wait until they become teenagers.
Oh my God, scare me to no end.
Yeah.
But making sure that they have a rote memorization of how to get out of their room and get out and exit the house, not to go to the basement like you do in a tornado or something, but out of the house.
And how often should you practice? You say it should be rehearsed, it should be practiced, people should know this. How often should you do that, Chad?
I think it depends on how ornery your children are. We have my family, I don't think we can get enough practice. That's genetically all from me, not their wife. My wife is much smarter and well-behaved than I am.
We're talking about home fires and other disasters here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Jeff has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. I had a question about smoke detector life expectancy. Got a house that was built in the mid to late 70s and has smoke detectors that are not only run by a battery, but it's also wired into the house. So they've been there, you know, I'm sure since the house was built, and didn't know if there was a, you know, sensor that senses the smoke, if it's got an expectancy of, you know, that might need to be replaced after 10, 15, 20 years.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jeff. I'll throw that one first to Chad.
It's a great question, and again, I'm not an expert in the devices themselves, but I have been on these install events, and we've seen hardwired alarms that are actually no longer hardwired as the house has been rewired or things have changed. People think it's hardwired.
Right.
Some of them have backup battery compartments where the backup battery is long dead. I think an alarm that old, a duplicate alarm, it's time. And you can call 317-684-1441, and we'll come give you one.
Has there been an evolution in smoke detectors, I mean the technology, or are they basically – because that raises a question for a lot of people, particularly I would think older people. You buy a house, and if you're in it 30, 40 years ago, you think about changing the sofa or, you know, buying a new stove or buying a new refrigerator, but you don't really think – oh, maybe we ought to get new smoke alarms, something that's updated and more trendy. Have there been, Charlie, do you know if there have been, is the technology improved with them, or are we still operating with basically the same model?
I don't know anything about the technology evolution in the last 20 years or so. I do know enough to say that after 5 to 10 years, you just replace them. If there's a question in your mind about it, especially when you're going to these older homes, as Chad had made the point, when you get into an older home, especially one that you bought, you have no idea what the wiring is. You have no idea what's behind those walls. And for something that is so inexpensive and now, thanks to the Red Cross, completely free, no excuse not to just go get a new one. So if there's a question out there, I just tell folks, get a new one.
So if you have a doubt, they should, Chad, they should call you and say, and you guys will provide new smoke alarms for them?
We will. We'll provide it along with a visit to your home. We'll drill it in the wall, and we'll even go over a fire escape safety plan with you and your family if you like. We take those by appointment. Again, calling our office, and we're happy to do it.
Okay, well, give people the number again, because my guess is, particularly with this point in the discussion, a lot of people were thinking, oh, boy, I have no idea how old my smoke detectors are.
Yeah.
I probably ought to call and check or get them updated.
It's easy. You can call us at 317-684-1441. And I will say that we're not sanctimonious about preparedness. I always laugh. I've been the CEO of the Red Cross now for a little over almost a year and a half. And the day before I took this job, I had one functioning smoke alarm, and now I have five. Okay. So it's not intuitive, and it's okay, and we'll come install one for you.
And where, you know, roughly if people aren't doing it with the Red Cross or whatever, or if they're wondering, are my smoke alarms in the right places, where should people put them? In their houses.
If I may, every community fire department will be happy to come into your house and show you phone call.
Okay.
That is the best.
So there's no rule of thumb
Well, we don't put them in kitchens generally, and we like to say in sleeping areas for sure. But Charlie's absolutely right. Fire department partners love to do this, and when we come and install, we'll provide that advice from trained volunteer experts as well.
So we're getting close to the end of the program here, and I do want to leave people with a walkaway. Other than calling the Red Cross, what are, and I'm going to ask for both of your thoughts on this, what are some of the most important things that they can do to make their home safe from fire or from carbon monoxide poisoning? I'll start with you on that, Charlie.
Get your children. Just no kids, period. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
my kids are such a threat. It's the basics that we had said before, again, in terms of simple, cheap, if not free, alarms. The carbon monoxide detectors are incredibly inexpensive today as well. I encourage everyone to have a working fire extinguisher in a few key places in their house to know where they're at and how they work. And then the plan, to have the conversation with everyone in the house on what the exit strategy is and where to meet up. And then lastly, and I just can't stress this enough, know your neighbor on your left and your right and use them as a resource and be willing to be a resource for them in exchange.
Chad.
Agreed. Smoke alarm, one on every level of your home, every sleeping area. That's key. Get out, stay out. You've got about 2 minutes to leave a burning house. Call 911. And as Charlie said, if you don't know your neighbor, and I don't mean like, you know, you'll wave at them when you're taking out your recycling bin. If you don't know your neighbor's phone number, their cell phone number, now's the good time. Listeners who leave here, go home this afternoon, randomly knock on a neighbor's door, introduce themselves, are doing more to build a resilient community than anything else they can do.
Let's take this from the other perspective. Suppose you are the neighbor, who has gotten that knock or whatever, or has heard the screams, knows that the house next door is in flames. What can you do to help your neighbors who are in obvious distress at that point? Chad, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, an earlier caller talked about the need for psychological first aid, and I think for untrained lay folks, often that just starts with a hug. One of the things our volunteers do from fires is show up, give people a hug. Maybe a cup of coffee. We give them a credit card with some money to get their life back on track. But look, neighbors can do a lot. Fires, as Charlie mentioned earlier, they strike to the core of who we are. We're seeing our possessions gone. And just knowing that there's someone there for them makes a huge difference.
Charlie.
I can't echo that enough. I really have nothing else to add other than what Chad had said. It's those are the most important things.
Gotten an email from a listener named Deborah, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Deborah writes that she spent 35 years teaching kindergarten and IPS, one of the best programs ever. Wants to say hello to firefighter Ike and his great crew at Survive Alive. Our children learned so much. Probably ought to talk with them about what Survive Alive is real quickly.
Sure, and I hope I do this justice, but Survive Alive is a program that's been in place for quite a while here in Indianapolis. We're very fortunate to have it. It is a field trip essentially for the kids where they spend half a day going through fire safety in so many different settings. They learn the basics and the survival skills that matter. And like I said, IFD and the fire union do just an amazing job of keeping that going. They have truly committed to that program, and that program absolutely saves lives.
Are there other things that we could be doing or should be doing to build this kind of resilience that we've been talking about? I'll stick with Charlie, but I want to hear Chad's thoughts.
Yeah, again, this really comes back to when, and I say this coming from my role in the EMS emergency side, really working in the municipal space for so long. It is the social infrastructure work that is so important. When you see the devastating house fires and you see the devastating losses that communities endure in for reasons that are just so preventable and simple things, simple resource allocation, simple programs that can go into particular communities to make sure that preventable causes of fires don't happen, that folks have a heater, folks have food, folks have blankets and whatnot that neighbors check on one another to provide those things. I just can't stress how that is so critical on the prevention side rather than the recovery response side. And that's so much of what we try to build today in the healthcare sector, in the social work sector and whatnot, the mental health sector. We've really gone after that principle over and over and over again, is go after the fundamentals that matter.
Chad.
The things that keep communities safe are well validated by the science. It is communities that have individuals with health care, where neighbors know each other, where there is good cooperation between NGOs and government officials, where there is appropriate risk communication. These communities do well in crisis. And for most of those things, we turn to the basic needs service providers around our communities. Emergency management is not the purview alone of the Red Cross. It is every partner of ours in the United Way, the EMS, fire departments, the city of Indianapolis, and most importantly, neighbors in communion with one another in their neighborhoods. And that's what keeps us safe.
Are there communities, we mentioned that we're near the top, you know, in terms of doing well. Are there communities that do it even better than we do?
Oh, I think there are. I mean, I think Boston's a great example. I mean, we saw a resilient community in action following the marathon bombings, and that's because they've paid very close attention to these determinants of resilience and have taken a very strategic approach there.
Well, I think that probably will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank both of you. It's been an illuminating conversation. I know now that I'm done, I'm going to go home and check how old our smoke alarms are.
Absolutely.
And make sure that all the batteries are right. So if there's no other takeaway than that, it's been a profitable hour. I'd like to thank my guest, Chad Priest. He is Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross Indiana. Dr. Charles Miramonte, who is Chief of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services. He's also Chief Medical Officer for Mesh Coalition. They're both on the faculty of the IU School of Medicine. I'd like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments and invite everybody to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about a new quality of life study of South Indianapolis. Promises to be fascinating. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.